Right, good evening everyone and welcome to the Palmerston North City Library, our wonderful, that word again Philippa, living room of the city. It's with great pleasure that I welcome you here this evening and also our wonderful guests. And without much more ado, I'll just ask Philippa Elphick, our New Zealand and Pacific Islands zone librarian. It was a fiction zone last night, to come up and introduce our first guest, Philippa.
Good evening, everybody. It's lovely to see you here. This is perhaps our sort of final library event for Local History Week, although we do have that fabulous walk at the Hoffman Kiln tomorrow at 2 o'clock, which we've unfortunately had fully booked up, but there's been a lot of interest in the walks, so we've had a fantastic week of events. I just wanted to begin my introduction of Douglas by saying, or talking a little bit about the week actually, and just saying I've been lucky enough to go on all the guided tours around the city as part of Local History Week, and I've wandered around fabulously preserved 1930s state housing precincts at Savage Crescent, and I've gazed up at Art Deco buildings around the CBD and wandered through the back rooms of the Regent, that was yesterday, and visited old churches designed by such esteemed architects as Frederick de Jersey Clare, and I've done that all right here in Palmerston North. Now, looking at our older buildings around the city, has reinforced to me how very important they are in terms of reminding us who we are and where we've come from, who's gone before, and also in doing so, enriching our experience of living here. I've been inspired, I suppose, by these walks, and it's reminded me, to quote Dr. Jock Phillips, who was here on Thursday night, that this land has been peopled for a long time. So I looked at these buildings and thought, yes, this is what's come before. And, you know, some of them look very different. And, yeah, it just makes this a very interesting place to live in. So tonight, it seems fitting that we are rounding off Local History Week with one of the most influential design writers in the Southern Hemisphere. That's another quote, but I love that quote. So does Douglas, because he sent it to me. As an author, many of you will know Douglas Lloyd Jenkins through the articles that he's written for publications, popular publications like The Listener, Home and Entertaining, New Zealand Heritage, and other New Zealand publications. You may also have seen him on the telly. I was just talking to Douglas about that wonderful series he did of New Zealand at Home. And that, of course, was based on his book At Home, A Century of New Zealand Design. Now, that won the top non-fiction prize in 2005. Wonderful, wonderful book. And Bruce McKenzie down the back's got copies of that tonight, I see. Douglas looked at the homes that we've built, or the buildings that we've built, homes that we love and that we live in, and looked at them from the perspective of what they say about New Zealand culture and us as a people, really, I suppose, as a nation. So I love that about the program, and I definitely love that about the book. He's also published a book profiling talented and sometimes neglected New Zealand artists and designers in that book called 40 Legends of New Zealand Design. That's a very special book as well. It's one of my favourites. And his latest book, which I've yet to get my hands on actually, because someone else has got it out at the moment, is a study of the Southern architect Ted McCoy. So I want to be having a look at that as well. And I know from hearing Douglas speak at Auckland Readers and Writers last year that he's also a passionate collector. He spoke at a lovely session called Collectomania. So there were some fabulous stories there about the passion for collecting and, you know, just having to have that one item and then getting it. How fabulous. And also, I believe, an Art Deco enthusiast. Well, you couldn't really live in Napier and not be, could you? So Douglas does live in Napier. He's currently director of the Hawke's Bay Museum and Art Gallery. So please welcome tonight Douglas Lloyd Jenkins.
Thank Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the Palmerston North Library for inviting both Peter and I over here, and we've actually never shared a bill before, so that's quite new. I haven't been able to spend any time in Palmerston North since I filmed the big art trip here, the Palmerston North section, quite some years ago, and it's nice to be able to come back. It's a city, I think, that deserves a little bit of time and a little bit of attention, and I discovered this myself one day when I've got very, very good friends in Whanganui, and I must confess, I tried to skirt around Palmerston North, but missed the Fielding turnoff, and found myself skirting around the outskirts of Palmerston North and discovering something called Liberty Land, which all of you will be familiar with, I am sure, but a totally engrossing 1930s streamlined building, and I spent a great deal of time amongst the buyers of underwear seconds, browsing the architecture with quite astonished looks to the ladies behind the counter when I, you know, can I help you? Or no, thank you, I'm looking at your ceiling. And it really did, coming here today, made me realise, again, I've been out, as you'll see, a little bit of what I'm going to talk about on the street, taking photographs of some very, very wonderful buildings. And Liberty Land, I suppose, it doesn't feature today, but it's one of those things that comes into this talk, really, something that we think of as ordinary and we probably don't give a lot of thought to, but actually is a very important part of our history and the way we think about ourselves. My staff at the art gallery, who are, you know, mostly much younger than me, charmingly call my laptop, which I have loved and adored for many years, an antique. And I think it's being antique at the moment. I always feel like this is like showing the contents of your handbag, so I had a clean up before I came. There we go. Okay. What I'm going to talk about tonight, it's called The Importance of Ordinary Things, had its origins in a paper prepared some time ago for an organisation called Creative Hawke's Bay, long before I moved to Hawke's Bay, on the subject of Ocean Beach. Now, I've since been informed by people that almost every province of New Zealand has an ocean beach, so you just can't say Ocean Beach. So I'm talking about Ocean Beach outside Hastings. I perhaps should say that the subject of development at Ocean Beach, which many of you may have heard about largely through national radio, who have followed the plans quite extensively, is not the subject of this talk. However, in 2005, having visited this beach, acclaimed for its natural landscape values, its unspoilt environment, I found myself having come away with many, many photographic images. But most of those consisted of images of a toilet block, a surf club building, and a surf club patrol tower. I'd taken these images because it was those objects that seemed to me to locate that beach in the New Zealand environment. Other characteristics for which the beach is more usually celebrated, the sun, the sea, the sand, the sky, its sheer expanse, although impressive, seemed to my mind interchangeable with the sensation of most spectacular beaches to be found here or anywhere else in the world. That is not to say that such things should not be protected, nor that they should not be valued, but to me, the natural aspects of the site were not what was unique about my first trip to Ocean Beach. I used these images as part of a paper arguing that we need to develop or learn to develop sites in a way that represents the way New Zealand culture builds rather than importing models of complete towns created by American or American-influenced town planners. I still recall the image of the proposed new Ocean Beach surf tower incorporated into the steeple of a mock Cape Cod cathedral-style clapboard church, which seemed to me to be alien in every sense of the word. I should perhaps explain, there is currently a project to build more than 1,000 houses on Ocean Beach, and it's being done by an Australian firm, and they want to build this sort of mock colonial town. And this what appears to be a church is their surf club building that they want to build on the site. After the paper, a number of people commented to me that they'd never really noticed the surf tower, my surf tower, not that surf tower, nor the toilet block, though one hopes they did notice the toilet block when they were visiting Ocean Beach. Or perhaps they noticed it as a public convenience, but they didn't notice it as a significant part of the built environment. But now that their attention had been drawn to them, they could see interesting characteristics that had hitherto escaped their attention. When they thought again about their personal relationships to Ocean Beach, they began to see that those structures were significant to their memory of the specifics of that place. Ocean Beach would not be quite the same, or not quite the same experience, without the presence of these objects. At the same time, I went on a trip to the UK and to Europe. Such was my academic life then. I was delivering a paper on the way that 20th century New Zealand had represented itself in international exhibitions, usually displaying exhibitions of fruit. In a way, it was a very Hawke's Bay kind of project. This exhibition included cities as various as London, Wolverhampton and Berlin. On this trip, I was accompanied by a young academic on his first trip overseas. And what I found very interesting about travelling with him was his choice of photographic subject matter. Yes, there was the occasional photograph of Big Ben or the Reichstag, but on the whole, he took photographs of otherwise unnoticed day-to-day details. A curb, a footpath, a road surface, a street sign, a light switch, a plug. Indeed, nothing seemed too obscure to be captured. Although I pitied the family that on his return might have to sit through that particular slideshow, an electric plug in Berlin, a light switch in Wolverhampton, when I asked him what he was doing, he answered that these were the things that stood out for him as different from those things at home, and therefore they were the things worth remembering. I don't have his photographs, but I have the equivalent sort of thing taken today on the streets of Palmerston North, and if you know where all of these things are, you know your city pretty well. What he was doing was recording the ordinary things that to him made those new cultures he was seeing for the first time distinctive. Less interesting to him were the galleries of British or German painting. More important were the street posters and the cafe flyers. Examining more closely what he was doing, in each case he was essentially recording the Englishness or Germanness of those objects. I began to think about the objects that we as New Zealanders notice or don't notice. Which objects do we consider to be important? Which objects do we ignore? I began to think about the inspiration that designers and architects might draw on and asked to what extent can ordinary objects empower a culture, particularly one in search of its own sense of identity. What I want to talk about tonight has two parts. Firstly, I intend to discuss the desire expressed by New Zealanders for a distinctive national identity, and in this case, a national design identity, expressed primarily through architecture and design. And secondly, I want to examine how New Zealanders' search for such properties tends to overpower the potential offered. It is my intention to move between notions of the work, the word design as expressed in architecture and as expressed by objects. This might suggest the motivation of objects of architects and object makers are one, but it might also should be also recognised that they often use the words design differently. The issue of national identity, particularly as it applies to design and architecture, is not currently a very popular one, not least among architectural academics or many practicing architects or designers. Contemporary academia is too clearly fixated with the prize of international recognition to find much fertile territory in local circumstances. Similarly, many contemporary practitioners seem more concerned with international models and international references to seriously pursue a strongly regionalist agenda. Indeed, regionalism is something of a dirty word. However, the existence of a distinctive design culture does remain a key issue with the broader public. It is my experience that given the opportunity to chat with an expert in design or architecture, it takes New Zealanders only a moment to ask the big question: do we have a distinctive design or architectural culture? The request is usually delivered in a plaintive tone, heavy with the expectation of a negative reply, but equally pregnant with the hope that the thing that they search for might indeed prove to exist. You know, I get this all of the time. Have we got an architecture? Have we got an architecture that's not English? And, you know, it's a sort of terrible thing where they just want you to say no, but they're hoping you're going to say yes. They never like the answer. There are two central problems in this request. One is the belief that a distinctive national design culture will be something that an expert will recognise first and deliver to a surprised but pleased audience. A sort of response which would be, well, thanks for that. I never realised that's what I was supposed to be doing. I'll go out and build one of them. That sort of moment. And I say, you know, as right at this moment, there's a bit of an irony that I'm sort of standing up here as an expert saying, look at our culture. The problem here is that there's a belief that there exists some sort of gap between the word culture and the lived circumstances of the people that live in a society, and therefore who might be expected to produce the culture in question. As New Zealanders, we've come to believe that we are not cultured, and that culture, where it exists, dwells amongst a limited body of professionals, architects, designers, artists, poets, and writers, that armed with superior knowledge of the arts, will produce something that we can admire but seldom truly embrace. This could be called the landfall scenario, in which a group of high-minded intellectuals get together and create a small, admirable, even important journal, but one that remains difficult to embrace, and indeed is difficult to read on any cover-to-cover, just-for-fun level. The reality is that culture, in the broadest sense, is what a group of people produce, what they do, and what they think important, rather than that is imposed as an academic construction. Academic constructions of any sort tend to be rather fragile life forms designed for the inner life of the institutions that produce them. Conversations that might have long academic lives, and over the last decade or so, most of those have been involved in applying the opinions of a limited set of contemporary French philosophers to local circumstances, never tend to have anything more than a short life when exposed to the broader public. It might be different in a university town, but you go up to someone on the street and try and chat about Derrida, see what happens to you. The conversation won't be lengthy. If the first issue is the expectation that culture will be delivered from an expert source, the second is the expectation of what will be delivered. That is, what contemporary New Zealanders want to have delivered to them as evidence of their culture. What is it we're looking for when we talk about the notion of a visible design identity? We would probably expect that any national design or national spirit in design would reflect the character of that nation or peoples that produced it. For example, contemporary New Zealanders tend to admire design cultures like Italy, France, or Scandinavia. And I think it's significant that in the early 21st century, New Zealand struggles to celebrate English culture, but we'll touch on that later. We admire the French for their sophistication, the Italians for their relaxed flamboyance, and the Scandinavians for their elegant restraint. In part, this is because these are characteristics that we as New Zealanders aspire to. The answer that many New Zealanders wish to hear is that we have a national design of some discernible elegance, sophistication, and polish. The news is not good. What New Zealanders are less comfortable with is embracing terms like pragmatic, crude, and cheap, which are more reflective of our built culture than are the terms sophisticated, flamboyant, or refined. Such terms seem negative. They seem derogative and quite impossible to embrace. Yet if we turn to the surf tower at Ocean Beach, it's its characteristics, those appealing characteristics, beyond its sensational location, are based in pragmatism. Note the choice of surfaces. Its economy of materials, that is, its cheapness, its relative crudity, both in terms of decision-making and construction. Now, this is a very good example. You saw it a moment ago on a blue wall in Palmerston North somewhere. This sort of plumbing detailing is the sort of thing a Kiwi plumber considers to be just fine, but the sort of thing that an Italian or a German would go nuts if they saw this. But we're not very good at saying, well, this is the way we build in New Zealand. We tend to be embarrassed by this sort of thing, but in reality, this is the way New Zealanders solve construction problems. The same points might also apply to its neighbouring structures, the toilet block and the surf club, which are all cheap, crude and pragmatic. Characteristics that might be brought together by using the term modest, unpretentious. Let's look at the Ocean Beach toilet block. Forget for a moment that it's a public toilet, and notice that the interior has a quality of light that is in every way as admirable as that found in the little whitewashed houses that dock the Greek islands, that are so often held up as models of architectural inspiration in the decor magazines. Look at the cubicle door, as redolent with a definable sense of craft as is any wood door attached to the most much photographed houses and cottages of Provence. Again, a very Kiwi way of solving a problem. Very straightforward, very direct. This is the way we actually make things, and it's something we probably need to start embracing. The external form of detailing of the toilet block is as restrained as any Scandinavian home. There might not be much Italian flamboyance here, but there is much that we should admire and perhaps replicate in more complex and indeed more sophisticated structures. So why can't we embrace the model presented by this type of structure? And let me say that it's not the toilet block per se, but the properties it presents that offer these qualities as a product of a distinctive culture. After all, the basic modest batch was once the exemplar offered up by New Zealand architecture. The problem is that those terms, crude, pragmatic, and cheap, summarised loosely by the term modest, which can be applied to so many aspects of New Zealand's built environment, that they are not only not sophisticated, but they are not aspirational. No one aspires to be crude. Well, some people I've met seem to, but in this lies one of the problems at the heart of contemporary New Zealand design. Indeed, aspiration has become one of the central problems in New Zealand contemporary culture. At the moment, New Zealanders all seem intent on going somewhere. Leaving something behind has become something of a national pastime. As a culture, we seem bent on a project of self-improvement through the acquisition of objects, in particular in the acquisition of aspirational objects. We collectively aspire to bigger houses, and indeed to the terror of the Reserve Bank, we seem to aspire to more houses. Despite the effect on the environment, we want bigger cars. Although what gets shown on television gets worse every year, we want the biggest television screens on which to watch it. We want larger kitchens than our grandparents, who did actually cook three meals a day, could ever have imagined, let alone used. We now tell ourselves that we need a bathroom for every person who occupies the house. And this was a conversation I overheard a little while back with an Auckland real estate who said you really couldn't settle for anything less than a bathroom for every occupant of a house anymore. The woman was slightly mad. Whereas a quarter acre section was once standard, we now tell ourselves we cannot achieve indoor-outdoor flow without a quarter acre deck. So the question becomes, can the national impulse, the national desire for distinctiveness, survive the aspirational nature of contemporary culture if the distinctiveness of that culture's design environment is based on the notion of modesty? For the moment, aspiration seems to have proven something of a death knell to nationalism. Architecturally, the central works in the construction of a national framework have historically been the foray. You'll have to excuse that slide. It's a rather lovely 30s wallpaper, but my nice foray slide decided to melt down on the trip over, so I happened to have this wallpaper slide on my... I could drop in. So the foray... The settler's cottage, went by rather fast, the wool shed, and the batch, all of which might then and might still today be considered ordinary things or ordinary objects. These were the things that architects in the 1940s and 1950s saw as the structures that we could use to build a nationalist architecture. These are the things we should draw on. Now, they weren't too embarrassed at the time to mention it because they didn't much like them, but we should now add to that list the first generation of state houses. And although that's not a state house, it is Michael Joseph Savage famously carrying in furniture to the first state house in New Zealand. When I made New Zealand at Home and people would ask me what I was doing, I said I was making a documentary series on the New Zealand house, and everyone to a person said, oh, on state houses. And it made me realise that to most New Zealanders, the first generation of state houses is considered to be one of the great achievements of New Zealand architecture, although architects seldom think like that. The foray, the settler's cottage, the wool shed, the batch, and now the state house are all objects that first came to the attention of New Zealanders in the 1940s, when, buoyed up by the centenary of Pākehā settlement in New Zealand, a search was implemented for authentic built expressions of the national culture or identity. In part, these were, as I mentioned before, delivered from on high by cultural commentators and culture makers, but to greater and lesser extents, they were embraced by professionals and ordinary Kiwis through the following decades. Indeed, aspects of the original inspiration can be seen alive and well in the built culture still. Yet interestingly, these models, particularly those of the wool shed and the batch, possess the very same characteristics as our ocean beach properties, our toilet book, our surf tower, pragmatic and often seemingly crude. Seemingly because they were in fact functionally complex and often carefully crafted, certainly cheap and above all modest. Full of cultural aspiration, they lack the more problematic characteristics of consumer aspiration. That's a lovely batch interior. To greater and lesser extents, these original sources, the wool shed, the batch, went through something of a transformative process which created a new object. New Zealanders, with a yearn for progressive architecture in the 50s, did not move into wool sheds, but into houses inspired by wool sheds. And that transformation is important. Vernon Brown, the Auckland architect, most often seen as the central figure in the nationalist dialogues, he did not build batches, indeed he would have been rather upset if you called his house a batch, but he took some inspiration from their simplicity. Similarly, those architects that followed in his footsteps tended to take inspiration from those sources and make decisions along a continuum of applied sophistication in both making and design. So the group architects might offer houses that push the boundaries of comfort in their expression of shed-like characteristics, while other architects might choose to add considerable polish to the form. The group architects, for those of you who don't know them, were a group of radical New Zealand architects, largely really architecture students to start with, working in Auckland in the late 40s and early 1950s. And their houses were often rather hard to live in, indeed one of them. The architect couldn't find a way of fitting a laundry in, and the poor woman who owned the house had to wash her things in a basin in the back garden because a laundry would have mucked up the architectural plan. So they weren't necessarily the nicest architects to work for, but they're stunningly beautiful homes. They got better. They found out ways of fitting the laundry in. Whereas in the 1950s, the woolshed dominated, in the 1960s and 1970s, it was the form of the settler cottage that began to come to the fore, and a new generation of architects created a new colonial architecture that was both distinctive and nationalist. And this is an example of a house from the mid to late 1960s by John Craig in Wellington, and a very fine example of a modernised colonial cottage that he built for his own family using that model. So I think many of you will be familiar with these types of houses through the 60s and 70s. They were identified as architecturally designed houses, but they drew on our own history, not an important one. And this is a rather funny little detail, just of the weatherboards of another house from that period, where they took on that very colonial notion of simplicity and crudity that made something very, very beautiful. And I think this sort of imagery in terms of New Zealand house building is often compared to the great traditional Japanese houses in which materials are allowed to age. And this is one of my all-time favourite houses. I think it's one of the great houses of New Zealand architecture. This is on Waiheke Island, and it's by an architect called Gordon Smith, 1974. A little bit hard to tell from this slide, but each room, this is the main central part of the house. There's a kitchen and a lounge and a bedroom and a study, but all the other rooms of the house are separate rooms, a laundry, bathroom, a bedroom, two other bedrooms and a studio, but they're all connected by walkways around a large pudakawa tree that you can see there. So the traditional hall of the New Zealand house is exposed and made external. And on Waiheke, where it's largely warm and nice all year round, you can do that. A 4 a.m. walk to the bathroom is not a terrifying thing, which would be in a colder climate. But again, based very much on the settler cottage, but producing a distinctive new architecture. More recently, we've seen New Zealand architecture and design going through a period of some buoyancy, basking in the attention of a public that are, for the moment, design and architecture fixated. We have, since the early 1990s, seen a rapid rise in the growth of design awareness, or at least engagement. We've seen New Zealanders make rapid appearances in the New Zealand home and architectural media. There's an incredible number of what we call nesting magazines in New Zealand for a country of a very small population. We celebrate the batch, and then we build holiday homes on a scale that has none of the characteristics of the batch except its site. This house, which is in the Bay of Islands, has been a subject of some personal loathing from me. I've written about it a number of times. It is based on the two old boat sheds that were completely rebuilt, and this glass, what in architectural terms we call a mesion, Mies van der Rohe-inspired pavilion, was built between the two. The interesting thing about the batch is that the batch never allowed itself to dominate landscape, and it never allowed itself to dominate the beach. So if you look up from a beach towards a batch, you always get the impression that the landscape is embracing the batch, and your eye moves up into the land, connecting you, the sea, the beach all together. The new generation of beach houses loom over the beach, block the view, and therefore make the beach part of its property. What particularly amused me when this house was built is the owners appeared in New Zealand House and Garden, New Zealand Home and Building, saying that they were particularly proud of this house because it was so strongly connected to the local Maori culture, because local Maoris did the cleaning. There is an irony that although objects in New Zealand are often niche marketed as New Zealand made, inspiration for those objects comes from somewhere else altogether. Contemporary architecture has, to an extent, been caught up in an internationalist thrust. Designs presented as connected to the local landscape by virtue of, are presented as connected to the local landscape by virtue of the observation that they sit in that landscape, or that extensive glass windows look onto that landscape. Yet the cultural connection that these works make to the way we live as New Zealanders is less obviously expressed than it was in the homes of the 1970s. And the other thing to remember, of course, is that these are second houses. These are houses that people don't actually live in, they just visit. Whereas once we used to visit the batch and you swept it out with an old broom, today beach houses have internalised automatic vacuuming robots. Design and architecture, designers and architects have something to blame for the aspirational aspects of contemporary society. They have developed from the way that we have treated design objects. Indeed, the phrase designer object is part of the problem itself. What happens with, with disorganised people like me, as you drive over from Hawke's Bay and you find you've left your last page behind. So I discovered that a bit earlier today, but I thought that was probably a good idea, because what I want to do is rather go into a conversation about the problematic of a designer object, is perhaps talk a little bit for a moment about the notion of history, the notion of place, and compare perhaps the idea of how those things relate to the way we think in both, whether it be Palmerston North or Ocean Beach. We often tie up the notions of history with a notion of the distant past. And one of the things that I find as a museum director is that we're constantly being offered objects from the 19th and early 20th centuries, but people's notion of history seems to disappear about 1940, and approaches to potential donors around objects from the 1970s and 1980s often are met with amusement. I found writing as a historian is that there's a terrible thing when you turn up, particularly with an artist or a designer, because when the historians turn up, it means you're over, you've finished working. But the simple fact of the matter is that history is always moving on. Both of the objects in this photograph taken on Palmerston North today are equally important in their aspect of New Zealand and built culture, but we probably treasure one and don't treasure the other. So it's probably a little extreme to suggest this broken Victorian grill is treasured, but it probably has more admirers than this arm of this seat detail. What I often find with heritage is that we walk around looking at key buildings and we say, oh, isn't that a marvellous Art Deco building, or isn't that a marvellous town hall, or isn't that a wonderful work? But there's a great danger in cities that allow themselves to develop to the point where only those icon buildings are left. And we see this, I think, quite distinctively in some American cities, in which they will preserve something like the town hall almost in aspic, you know, perfect, but everything around it is a motorway exit, basically, or a high rise. I think if you take a walk on a New Zealand street with your grandparents or an older member of the family, it won't be the Town Hall or the Regent Theatre or the Napier Municipal Theatre or anything like that that they remember. It'll be small shops and small details. And I think one of the problems that we have with history is that we're always looking for these great moments, whereas in actual fact, history is all about small moments and about ordinary things. And what I think is very interesting in terms of the future of New Zealand design is that we seem to have two choices. And it might be a fairly basic argument, but one is that sort of globalised argument, where New Zealand designers and architects do indeed draw their inspiration from the glossy magazines from overseas, and there's some historical proof of that, or that they start looking locally and say, this is how we solve problems in New Zealand. Now, I recently gave a version of this paper to the New Zealand Federation of Building Inspectors, a pretty serious lot, who were quite, their whole conference was about leaky building syndrome. And I turned up about half an hour early for my delivery, and the man was still talking on the subject of mould and fungus and Pinus radiata. And he in that way that speakers sometimes had, went 45 minutes over his allotted time on the subject of mould and fungus. And I got up and delivered a paper very similar to this one, using some different examples from different places, looking at the way we build things. And the adjudicator got up and said, "Thank you, Douglas. It's very nice to end the day with something comic." So I think what I'm trying to do here today is encourage you to look at the ordinary details that surround you, realise that's the way we do things here, and when the time comes for you to build, to try and build in that ordinary manner, despite the fact that some people are going to think it's comic. Thank you. Yes, what I particularly mentioned was when I first went to Ocean Beach, I was actually asked to come down to give this presentation. I didn't live in Hawke's Bay, and Ocean Beach didn't mean anything to me, and I went and drove out there and went on a sort of tour. The developers were really quite interesting with this project. They had put together what was called a charrette, which was a sort of developer-led consultative process. So you can imagine that they consulted with you, and anything you said was turned into supporting them. And they took us all on this journey, and I took my photographs and prepared what I wanted to say at this charrette presentation the next day. But, you know, coming up afterwards, everyone who spoke to me, they didn't speak to me about being located in that place, identifying through Ocean Beach through the things that we would think of, which was sort of, you know, sand and surf. They talked about those structures. And I think that one of the interesting things about New Zealand is, you know, we tend to undervalue the built, because we're a nation of builders. We can build. We're quite happy and quite proud of building new things. But if we look at the way we build, a New Zealand house is a weatherboard house, really. A New Zealand house really has a pitched roof. Even though it doesn't snow very often in many places, we have a pitched roof. A flat roof isn't. It's sort of an imported house. And the imported model's been very common recently. We know from the 80s and 90s what happens when you don't have a weatherboard house. Water gets in and horrible things happen. And, you know, I think we've turned away from those materials, in part for economic reasons. But it's really interesting if you talk to foreign tourists when they come here, that they will say, you know, your buildings are very unusual. And they're not talking about what's out there. They're talking about the little weatherboard houses that line the streets. And I think, you know, that we underestimate how buildings do locate people in a place. You know, our memory is held in buildings. And we talk about our homes, our grandparents' homes, our parents' homes, the places we went to. Buildings are great holders of memory, and therefore I think they're big holders of sense of place. That answers your question. Yes? Yes. In the 1940s, architects became very concerned with finding a series of buildings that were built by New Zealanders without being, who weren't necessarily architects, because the architects of the 40s identified too much of the sort of architecture that was happening at that time, sort of arts and crafts houses and that sort of thing, as being English imports. So they said, if we took the architects out of the equation, what have we built that's of interest? And out of that came the foray, the wall shed, the settler's cottage, and the batch as the things that they identified. And it's really quite interesting. It doesn't last particularly long, but in the 40s and 50s, there are a whole series of essentially pākehā houses that have that big, large projecting porch on them. And it does become very stylized, very abstract, which was the nature of the 50s. But that is Bill Mackay, the Auckland academic architectural writer, has called it the foray face of modernism, or the forayed face of modernism. And you still spot them. And they're very distinctive New Zealand houses where the foray was feeding back into the mainstream housing culture. And today we don't even think of them as being sourced that way because of their very abstract nature. But they're all around.